This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. As the Islamic State continues its brutal attempts to conquer territory in Syria and Iraq, it is also destroying some of the irreplaceable culture of an area which has been home to numerous ancient civilizations. Archaeological digs are being looted, and precious relics, some from the earliest parts of recorded history, are being sold to fund ISIS terrorism. Our guests today have been helping to train experts and civilians alike in an effort to preserve the region's culture. Ryan Daniels is Director of Research and Programs at the University of Pennsylvania Museum's Cultural Heritage Center. He co-directs the Safeguarding the Heritage of Syria and Iraq project. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Amar Al-Azm joins us by phone. He is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Middle Eastern History at Shawnee State University. Welcome, Amar.
Thank you.
As we alluded to in the start of the show, this part of the world is among the richest in human history. Amar, if you could give us a quick sense of the ancient civilizations who were there before modern-day Syria and Iraq.
In the region, I mean, this is a region that's very rich in ancient history. It's called the Cradle of Civilizations because some of the earliest known civilizations arose from there. You have in Iraq, you have the Sumerians, ancient Akkadians, you have Assyria, you have Babylon. You know, the history goes back thousands and thousands of years, and the same for Syria as well. And together they provide a very rich and wealthy repository of amazing cultural heritage that's not just of great value to, obviously, the people of Syria and Iraq, but to the entire world.
Brian Daniels, which are some of the more significant sites which were being excavated at the time ISIS grabbed control?
Well, we have a number of sites in eastern Syria that have come under at least ISIS scrutiny and ISIS attention. And so these are sites across the Raqqa area, in Al-Hasakha, and in Deir ez-Zor. And so these represent sites going back thousands of years, but also up into the Roman period.
So what's happening now with these sites?
Well, what we're generally seeing is that there is some looting going on that's done by hand. But we're also seeing increasing numbers and increasing amounts of what you might call industrial-scale looting, looting that's being done with backhoes and bulldozers. But being done in such a way that excavates the most amount of earth for the maximum yield of material.
And I imagine that relics then are being damaged in the process?
One would expect so. But this may also be clearing some kind of overburden to expose things like mosaics. We know that mosaics seem to be one of the things that ISIS seems to be particularly interested in.
Amar, mosaics one, what are some of the other relics which are being looted?
Obviously, anything of value will be looted, but depending on the nature of the site, you know, like Brian said, mosaics are important, but these are going to only appear in sites that have Hellenistic and Roman deposits in them. A lot of the sites in the region, however, are much date much earlier, and these sites will more likely yield, pottery, small finds, rings, maybe some coins, bits of silver, gold, materials like that. And this is very important because this is why I think these groups are basically industrializing or trying to maximize their extraction, because they're going for quantity rather than quality. In terms of monetary value, many of these sites, unless you strike it rich and come out with a library with full of tablets or something like, or a large statue, most of these sites will produce these quantities of small finds, and therefore you really need to be sort of processing a lot of these sites at one time to make it, to make a profit.
Well, which was the next question, because if it's pottery and it's small rings, my understanding is ISIS is making millions of dollars out of this looting.
I mean, it's been reported that ISIS is making millions of dollars, and I have to admit that there's a lot of There's a lot of debate about exactly what the dollar figure that they're earning is. I mean, I have no question that it's a significant amount of money. There's a number that's bandied around in the media that's I feel a little uncomfortable with, $36 million from one particular site.
I've seen that, yeah.
And that one I think maybe too high. That's not to say that there's not significant amount of looting going on and a significant amount of income that ISIS is deriving from it.
Amr, the ISIS itself is not doing the looting. It has a system set up. Could you describe that for us?
Well, yes, but I think we need to start to adjust our knowledge, because certainly in the beginning it seemed that ISIS started off by contracting out, encouraging looting by locals and then taxing them for that. They would extract a tax which starts off at around 20%, and it comes off a Sharia law-based, 20%, which is called khums in Arabic. But gradually it started to increase that. And then eventually, as this whole process has evolved, we now find that ISIS now is actually much more involved itself in the actual looting, either taking on the looting itself, bringing in its own, and providing a lot of the backup now. Now they provide the heavy earth-moving equipment, for example, or contracting it out to private contractors who come in, and then they'll excavate the site, and then they'll basically hand over their share, whatever ISIS's share of the material is, or the recovered loot, and then it gets sold. ISIS is also very, very involved in the actual sale now. We know that there are known middlemen who basically are essentially working with ISIS for that, and the ISIS will provide them escort once they buy the material all the way to the borders, where they can then get the stuff out, most likely into Turkey.
Let's again just focus for a moment on some of the major pieces of antiquities artwork that might have come out of these sites. You mentioned mosaics earlier, Brian.
Yes, I mentioned mosaics.
What were they? What did they look like? What is their value?
They're oftentimes late Roman, early Byzantine period mosaics, and some listeners today might be familiar with material. Maybe perhaps from the Penn Museum in the courtyard there. There's a mosaic right in the entryway. A lot of it's not going to be altogether different from what they would see as they walked into the Penn Museum.
What would they see? Describe that for us.
They might see a figure, a god or a goddess. If it's early Christian material, it may be animals, plant patterns, and so on. And it's not necessarily going to be a huge chunk of mosaic. It might just be that little pattern, that little circlet of leaves, or maybe that kind of elaborate knot tie pattern or something like that. And that's what you may see kind of walking away in terms of the mosaics.
And the colors?
The colors, they'll be oftentimes earthen tones. I mean, reds, sometimes greens. I often find in this period of mosaic work, I find the subtlety of the color change to actually be really quite amazing. Some listeners may have visited the Zeugma Museum, which is in southern Turkey, and that museum has very similar mosaics to what we see in this area.
And let's get to the monetary value, but also the cultural value of something like these mosaics.
The monetary value is very difficult to discern, because this kind of mosaic material is not supposed to be sold, really. I mean, the market for this kind of mosaic material is a black market to begin with. And generally speaking, there's a few mosaics from mostly Italy that have been in the market for maybe 100 or so years, and this is perfectly legitimate. But so actually trying to put a price on this is actually quite difficult. And my own impression on this, and Amr may want to comment on this further, is that the market dynamics that normally govern the art market may not entirely apply to this material.
Amr?
I mean, these mosaics, when they do get sold, they go for many thousands of dollars, depending. And actually what determines the price is the complexity of the image. Like Brian was describing, the more color in it, the more variety in the actual, if you have images of people, if you have more intricate, elaborate scroll work or plant life or some sort of activity, these are the ones that fetch the big prices. And we're talking, tens of thousands of dollars if they're for the really, really, beautifully made often a lot of these mosaics are also simple geometric patterns, and or they will only find. And remember, they might, some of these mosaics could have been looted in earlier periods, even in historical periods. So sometimes what you'll find is the boring part of the mosaic, if there could be such a thing. But these can also be looted. But I also want to bring in another idea here. You see, we're not only seeing the looting and sale of antiquities from sites, but there's also a lot of fakes going around as well. And often we know that from Iraq, a lot of these fakes are coming through from Iraq, and then are being funneled through to Syria, and then from Syria being funneled out into Turkey again. The reason why I mention these fakes is because mosaics are one of those items that get faked a lot. And where they do find these mosaics, they'll rip them out, and if they don't see something that's very valuable, what they might do is break the mosaic up and then reuse the stones to essentially create a more beautiful image using the old stones themselves, and then these become much harder to detect. Obviously, you need to be a real expert to be able to detect these changes. So it's much more complicated in terms of how these mosaics are used, or any of these objects that are coming onto the market and getting the provenance of where they come from.
Amr, when these relics are either looted or destroyed, speak to the cultural value to the area that is affected.
Objects, the objects themselves are obviously important in the sense that they are part of the story. But the real story, the real historical value is in the context that they are found in. And that's where the real damage, in my opinion, is happening. You know, especially with these sites that are only producing pottery and small finds, maybe the odd piece of gold or silver. It's not the value of these objects in themselves, monetary or otherwise. It's the context that's being destroyed in order to extract these. Remember, as anyone who excavates, whether it's an expert archaeologist or a looter, you're actually destroying that layer every time you dig into it. And so we as archaeologists are very aware of this destructive process, and we take great care to record every single step and every single layer in meticulous detail, because that's the only record that's going to be left that preserves this. Whereas looters just dig basically, to try and get their material out. And if it's digging by hand, obviously they destroy a small area. But when you get this, using excavation equipment, diggers, backhoes, and so on and so forth, and it's done literally on an industrial scale, the destruction of this historical record is immense, and it's gone forever, and there's no record of it whatsoever. So even if the objects are retrieved by police or later on through whatever means, the history that goes with those objects is gone, and that's the irreplaceable part.
We're going to have to pause for a break here. Amr Al-Azam and Brian Daniels are our guests, and they were in the region to train curators, civilians, and heritage experts in an effort to salvage some of the items that are coming out of that area. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. Radio Times will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Bryn Mawr College invites artists, journalists, scholars, and experts to the campus to explore the reasons behind and the realities of dissent, violence, and justice. The series kicks off October 1st with a lecture by Mona Al-Tahawi, an award-winning columnist and international public speaker on Arab and Muslim issues based in New York. Her talk, titled Revolution, One Ism at a Time, The Global Fight Versus Sexism, Racism, and Other Isms, begins at 7 p.m. at Thomas Great Hall at Bryn Mawr College. No ticket required and open to the public.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The days of leper colonies in the U.S. may be past, but people still do get the debilitating disease.
I all the time have had patients say to me, "What have I done that is so bad that God is punishing me by giving me leprosy?"
Treating Leprosy in Texas, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Why? Fox Chase was recognized and highlighted among Philadelphia hospitals for safety and surgical outcomes based on a nationwide study. Surgeons at Fox Chase are fellowship trained with up to 4 years of additional training on the complex techniques of cancer surgery. Part of Temple Health, Fox Chase is committed to patient safety, world-class care, and the best outcomes. Fox Chase Cancer Center, your first choice in cancer care.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. Precious relics are being looted from archaeological sites in Syria and Iraq, and the proceeds are going to fund ISIS terrorism. Our guests today are helping to train experts and civilians to prevent further loss of irreplaceable antiquities. Amar El-Azam is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Middle Eastern History at Shawnee State University, and Brian Daniels is Director of Research and Programs at the University of Pennsylvania Museum's Cultural Heritage Center. If you have questions or comments, as always, we'd love to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499 is the number to call. You can send us an email if you like at radiotimes@whyy.org. or a tweet at WHYY Radio Time. So, Brian, you were in the region, you and Amar, to help train curators and civilians and heritage experts. You were not in Syria.
We were not in Syria. That's right. We were in southern Turkey.
And what did that training process involve? And what is the end game here?
So this was a project that we've been trying to put together for some time. I mean, I should say it was done in partnership with the Smithsonian Institution, and funded very generously by the J.M. Kaplan Fund in New York. And what our goal here was to bring a group of curators, heritage professionals, and civilian activists who were working under incredibly difficult conditions to document cultural heritage in museums, to document cultural heritage destruction, and to bring them together for a discussion. How are they doing this? What resources do they need to continue their work? What can we provide them that would help them continue to do their work? And we had a modest budget to be able to give emergency conservation supplies and other kinds of material that they could not otherwise obtain in Syria, and to send this group of curators and professionals back into Syria with this material.
Dangerous work?
For the people involved, absolutely. I mean, they had a very difficult time coming into Turkey. We kind of expected that. This training had been postponed three times because of security situations on the ground. And so we were there, I mean, to provide moral support, to provide resources, to provide expertise, and really anything that we could, because these are our colleagues in the museum field. These are curators. These are people who, you know, we might have met at other opportunities at other points in life.
Amar, could you address for us why these curators and others are willing to risk their lives to do this work?
I mean, I suppose because they feel a sense of responsibility for the cultural heritage. I mean, remember, many of these, you know, went to university, studied to become archaeologists, and then got jobs at the Department of Antiquities. And in fact, quite a number of them are actually ex-students of mine when I was a professor at the University of Damascus. So I knew them personally, and they knew me. And so, you know, and I can well understand why they would want to do that. And it's all, you know, you've got to appreciate this, that, you know, the Department of Antiquities in Syria, that's the government or state body that governs and manages cultural heritage in Syria. And, of course, once certain areas fall out of the control of the regime, so these are what you might call the liberated areas, then these employees, these archaeologists, suddenly find themselves basically at a loss. They no longer have the institution to pay their salaries, to basically back them up and provide them with the basic materials they need to carry on doing their daily work, in addition to obviously being in great physical danger, because sometimes their towns, cities, or even museums become targets during the fighting that is going on. So
sure.
These are the people that we wanted to bring in. These are the people we reached out to. And in this one place, the Mara Museum, Mara is this small town in northern Syria, just south of Idlib. We were able to reach out to these individuals. They knew us, they knew myself, they knew my colleagues who work with us as students of ours. We communicated with them. They said, how is it there? And they told us their needs, and we went from there and essentially put together this program that Brian just described.
Where does Syrian President Assad fall in all of this? Is the destruction of culture a concern of his?
You know, the Syrian Bashar al-Assad, the head of the Syrian regime, essentially from very, very early on made it very clear that anyone and anything that resisted his will to rule the country will be destroyed. And in fact, there is a slogan that is often repeated by supporters and by his army, the regime's fighting army, and that is al-Assad aw nahruq al-balad, which translates as Assad or we will burn the country. So this is for Assad, this is what the choice is. You either accept me and my regime as it is, the way I want to run it, or we will destroy everything that basically resists it. So to them, it's nothing. I mean, the Mara Museum is a well-known landmark. The city of Mara has been barrel-bombed continuously for the last almost 3 weeks now, and we've just received new images of barrel bombs that have fallen close to the museum, and the museum walls are now, in some cases, rather badly damaged, and there's a serious risk that these walls might may collapse over the mosaics that are kept in that museum. This is a very important, this museum holds one of the most important collections of museums in Syria. And if these walls collapse on the mosaics, these mosaics will be destroyed.
Brian Daniels.
And I think that just to follow up on the Mara Museum, we're working with the Smithsonian right now to actually do really an emergency intervention and conservation effort at the Mara Museum and really trying to sandbag, scaffold the walls in the anticipation that there is going to be additional barrel bombing. But what I would also say, sort of going back to the question of Assad's relationship in this, we're also working with the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences Geospatial Technologies Project in trying to actually do as close to real-time satellite documentation of damage as possible. And one of the things that we're starting to see is that it really does appear that there is intentional targeting going on by the Assad regime, particularly when it comes to barrel bombs in historic places and for certain periods of sites.
Let's get back to the training effort. You call this cultural triage?
I have called it kind of cultural triage. One of the things that we have to talk about is when you are faced in a situation where you only have enough time to save a couple of things, what do you choose? And it really does speak to the question of why are people willing to risk their lives on this? I mean, if you think about it, if your house caught on fire, and after you get out safely from your house, your next question is, okay, what about the family photos or my mother's wedding dress or my father's uniform, something like that, right? And these curators, these heritage professionals, their job is to care for the country's family photos and all of those other things that make it emblematic for Syrians to represent what it means to have a Syrian identity. And that's what I think motivates a lot of them in this case, is that they feel this heavy duty and this burden for this generation, but also future generations, to try and protect this material.
Are there any tough choices you can describe?
Well, one of the exercises that we did is we took the cohort that we were working with to a museum and actually gave them the exercise of forcing them to make choices about what to save in the museum, just to emphasize how hard it actually was to do it.
Describe what the choice was.
These were all choices between different kinds of mosaics, actually. And the and certain people had certain kinds of favorite mosaics that they wanted to save over others. There was a general consensus, of course, you wanted to save all of it. But if you only had time to save one or two, what they would be. And oftentimes it comes down to, especially in the Syrian case, what the portability prospect is. Mm-hmm. If you have to actually take it out of the museum, but you can't move the one embedded in concrete, is there another representative one that you can move that's more portable? And that was an area of that we talked about at some length.
We alluded a little bit earlier about how these artifacts are getting out of Syria and Iraq. What is the path, Amr, to the wider world?
Well, essentially, any border country, any country bordering Iraq or Syria, essentially is a potential path for these mosaics. So Jordan is, or object actually, anything being looted in Syria. So Jordan to the south, Lebanon to the west, Turkey to the north, and from Iraq, obviously, again, you have Iran and you have, I believe, Turkey up there as well. So really, Turkey is a main, I think, is one of the main sources, especially for the kind of areas that we're thinking of, that is the north and the east of Syria. Turkey is going to be the main route out.
And this is all underground?
It's all underground. It's all illicit. We know that these middlemen, and I should say middle women as well, basically come down. They're mostly Syrian, although there are some Turks involved. I believe there's... we have a small investigative team that basically operates inside Syria that tries to gather information for us. And I recently found out that there is a fairly well-known, apparently, Turkish lady, middle woman, that's why I said men or women, mm-hmm. that comes in, regularly into Syria and essentially buys these, looted antiquities, and then they take them back into Turkey. Where they then get sort of, dispatched through their underground network. And ultimately, all of this will probably end up back in Europe, and then from Europe will then bounce back out to wherever it is it's going to go around the world.
And there is no support, or is there support from the Turkish government in stopping this?
No. The Turkish government does cooperate with us, and I know because part of our operation is also done in conjunction with the interim government, the Ministry of Culture for the Syrian interim government, which is based in Gaziantep. But I know there is a lot of close cooperation between the Turkish authorities and them as well. And the Turkish, Turkey has very strict, very stringent laws about the smuggling and then trade in illegal antiquities, because obviously they also have a very rich cultural heritage themselves, and they don't like that being looted either, because looting goes on all over the world. So the Turks are very much on the ball on this. But still, I mean, because you have this, in Syria and Iraq right now, because you have no, strong, there's no government, it's basically loose, it's open, and anybody can come in. So it becomes much, much harder to control. And the border between Turkey and Syria is very, very long. It stretches, over 1,000 miles, so you have and it's fairly porous up there, so smuggling is not difficult.
All right. Amar Al-Azam is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Middle Eastern History at Shawnee State University. Brian Daniels, Director of Research and Programs at the University of Pennsylvania Museum's Cultural Heritage Center. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 1-888-477-9499. And we do have a tweet from Jonathan. Why wouldn't ISIS want to keep artifacts? Does that go against the big picture? And is nothing sacred? Brian?
The short answer to it is that there does not seem to be a sense that one would, that or these local ISIS emirs would want to actually kind of keep the museum. It appears to fall into an idea that it's some kind of reverent, keeping the pieces, keeping the statuary, keeping these artifacts gives them undue reverence, which goes against ISIS's ideology.
Also because they're a source of income.
Yeah, and frankly, they're a source of income.
Well, sure. I'd actually read that in particular the Shiites are at the short end of the stick here, because there is, a cultural veneration of tombs and shrines, and those are being destroyed by ISIS?
Yes.
Sorry.
No, go ahead, Amr.
In Islam, obviously, there are different, branches, and Shiites and Sunnis are the two main branches of Islam. In Shiism, you do have this phenomenon, whereas under strict Sunni Orthodox Islam, it's absolutely prohibited. And so that's one of the problems that essentially has been occurring, where ISIS, which are a very strict Orthodox, you know, they have a very strict Orthodox interpretation of their version, I should say, of interpretation of Islam, have been basically going to these shrines and they've been blowing them up. But, that's why this is happening.
I'd like to get to some news of the week. U.S. airstrikes, of course, began on Tuesday, targeting ISIS. Mm-hmm. So archaeological sites in danger of being hit?
Generally what happens before there's an airstrike like this, there's some background and thought that goes into exactly what the U.S. military is going to be targeting as part of the effort. And particularly after the looting of the Iraq National Museum in 2003, there was an increased awareness, I would say, within the Department of Defense that they made a mistake, a serious mistake. And the United States signed on to the 1954 Hague Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property in the Event of Armed Conflict in 2009, that many decades after they helped negotiate the treaty. And now there's something called a no-strike list of cultural property that's prepared by cultural heritage experts. And this feeds in directly to the Department of Defense to make sure that cultural heritage sites are not targeted. And during the Libya campaign a couple of years ago, there was very obvious success of the no-strike list preventing hitting World Heritage sites throughout Libya. And which sort of speaks to the success of this kind of U.S. commitment, which translates into NATO. And I'm hopeful that we'll be seeing the same thing here. The no-strike list on Syria was developed over 2 years ago. And so I'm hopeful that we're not going to see bomb damage on Syrian heritage sites.
Amr, do you feel that same hope?
Well, obviously, I share the same hope. My concern, however, is that just as we were able to work out a no-strike list based on important World Heritage sites, that does not mean that groups like ISIS are going to respect that, and they may well, go ahead and use those as bases. In fact, I know that some of these sites, particularly where you have fortifications or strong points like the Citadel of Jabara, which is a castle fortification on the Euphrates River. I know that they, between Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor, I know they're using this as a key base for that. Now, it's not a World Heritage site, but it's still a significant archaeological site, and I would hope that a site like that, even though ISIS does use it as a base, is avoided.
And what happens in those cases is, it's something called, there's an issue of military necessity. And so no one under this treaty wanted to imagine hamstringing U.S. forces. But it means that the commander who actually has the tactical command of the area during the bombing campaign or whatever campaign it is has to make decisions about what and what not to do based upon the awareness that it is a heritage site. And so there's certain levels of command it has to go through before it's targeted.
All right, this is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. We are talking about precious antiquities which are being looted from archaeological sites in Syria and Iraq and efforts to prevent further loss of these relics. Brian Daniels is Director of Research and Programs at the University of Pennsylvania Museum's Cultural Heritage Center. Amr Al-Azam is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Middle Eastern History at Shawnee State University. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, here is the number. It is 1-888-477-9499, or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents The 39 Steps September 30th through October 26th. Mix a Hitchcock masterpiece with a juicy spy novel, add a dash of Monty Python, and you have The 39 Steps. This hilarious whodunit features over 150 zany characters, played by a very talented cast of four, an onstage plane crash, handcuffs, missing fingers, and some good old-fashioned romance. Tickets at brtstage.org or 215-785-0100.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.
The promise of genetically modified crops.
How do we double the amount of food between now and 2050?
But activist Vandana Shiva says Monsanto Corporation is destroying the third world.
It's based on stealing the biological heritage of the third world.
Searching for the truth about GMOs next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. And our focus this hour is on efforts to preserve the ancient cultural heritage of Syria and Iraq. Architectural sites are being looted, the proceeds going to fund ISIS terrorism. Our guests include Brian Daniels, Director of Research and Programs at the University of Pennsylvania Museum's Cultural Heritage Center, and Amar Al-Azam is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Middle Eastern History at Shawnee State University. And our telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. Brian, we were just chatting for a moment off mic about the great minaret of Aleppo and its destruction and the galvanizing effect that it had on the area. Could you get into that a little bit more? Tell us the story in brief, if you would.
Yeah, The World Heritage Site, the ancient city of Aleppo, has it's been described as an absolute war zone. It's possibly the most war-torn World Heritage Site in existence, and it's been absolutely devastated. And the destruction of the minaret a couple of years ago, I mean, it had a galvanizing effect, I think, on the International World Heritage Committee, because it was equivalent to losing the Bamiyan Buddhas again in Afghanistan. Mm. It was that dramatic, an international landmark, that recognizable. And it was a kind of a wake-up call that this is an incredibly severe conflict. The risk to cultural heritage is terrible, in addition to the humanitarian risk. And there was this moment where the two worlds began, I think, to merge. And there was this awareness that the loss of these incredibly important ancient Syrian sites was really about erasing the past of the Syrian people. And this... I think that there was an awareness, too, that the moment that the threshold of destroying the minaret was made, the moment we crossed that threshold, the destruction of everything else was clearly possible if something that precious was going to go. And I think that that became this kind of tipping point where all of a sudden it became okay to have indiscriminate barrel bombing. I mean, okay in great big scare quotes here. But there was no restraint at that point, if that minaret was gone.
Amar, your thoughts?
I mean, I obviously support what Brian is saying, and I would add the following. I mean, you know, Aleppo is an incredible city. Just to put this into context, this is one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities in the world. The souks, just the souks alone, the old markets, these go back to the 13th century, continuously used as living, breathing medieval markets that were in use right up to this day, busy, filled with thousands of shops and stores, businesses, and business being done exactly as it had been done as it was perhaps hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Perhaps only the quality and type of materials and goods being sold there in some cases would have changed. And in some cases, it's the same goods and materials that have been traded and sold in that city, right up to, you know, its first beginnings. And all of that was destroyed. Just to give you a sense of the destruction, that when Aleppo basically was lost to the regime immediately launched a punitive attack against the city. And one of the first areas to be targeted were those old souks, which were burned to the ground, completely destroyed by the regime. This is how severe the damage is. And trying to save this heritage, trying to save what's left, is a very, very difficult task. Only 2 days ago, I received some photos, the latest photos from the minaret in the mosque that you were just talking about. And obviously, the minaret had fallen down. It's collapsed, and the stones are in the rubble. And we believe it's very important to try and save these stones in situ, so that we can then, once the fighting is over, once the war is over, an effort can be made to essentially reconstruct that and recover that. And so I was discussing with some of the guys from Aleppo how we might be able to do that and how we might be able to cover those stones. And they explained to me that they could only cover one part of it because there's a certain part of that area that is exposed to a sniper that the regime has placed on the other side specifically to shoot at anybody who comes anywhere near that. So even in trying to save this cultural heritage, those individuals who are going to try and cover up those stones, you know, are going to be running the risk of being shot by a sniper.
Hmm. How does the Arab world view the destruction of irreplaceable history like this?
I mean, obviously, they're going to be, you know, everybody. It's not just for the Arab world. It's the whole world that looks upon this destruction in horror. You know, the Arab world is as shocked as anyone else, and particularly when it comes to important Islamic monuments such as the Grand Mosque in Aleppo. It's a huge loss, and it's not just the monuments, but the cultural heritage and the history that goes with it. And I think it's important to understand this. You know, there is a real problem when you destroy such important cultural heritage. You know, it goes back to the whole issue of Syrian identity. You know, what makes a Syrian a Syrian? And what makes a Syrian a Syrian is this shared common history and cultural heritage, that the rich cultural heritage that goes with it. And so by destroying that rich cultural heritage, you're essentially not only destroying Syria's past, but you're also destroying any chance that Syrians have of coming back together and reconciling themselves, because once this war is over, Syrians are going to have to look for common denominators that bring, you know, those symbols that once held them together. And that history and that cultural heritage was one of those few things that did hold them together. And if that's gone, then it's going to be even that much harder for Syrians to come back and reconcile themselves.
I guess the question I'm asking is there physical support from surrounding countries in your effort to preserve the cultural history of Syria and Iraq?
I mean, certainly in terms of neighboring countries, I mean, I can tell you that the Lebanese government, the Department of Antiquities in Lebanon, does try and provide what help it can if they intercept any looted materials. And the same for Turkey, obviously. So Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, when they do intercept looted materials, they'll take possession of it. They try to control, prevent anything being sold or taken out of the country. Certainly in Turkey, we've been able to get some materials out and put them there for safekeeping. But beyond that, no, not really. If you're thinking, are there any efforts by neighboring countries to provide, training or assistance in the same way that we're doing? Not really. We haven't sort of received anything like that.
Let's take a look at, again, we'll examine a little bit more fully where these objects end up. And I know you said they go to Europe and I guess eventually to the United States. What is the U.S. policy when artifacts that are illegally obtained turn up here?
So it varies actually country by country because of the way that the U.S. pattern of law works. And it's probably in some ways easier to deal with the United States last because it's somewhat of an exception. There is an international convention, the 1970 UNESCO Convention, that governs the importation and circulation of essentially looted cultural material. And most countries in the world have signed on to this convention in some form or another. The degree to which they enforce it varies considerably. And so, for instance, for the Syria material, I worry greatly about a lot of this ending up in the Gulf states, and a lot of it right now seems to be transiting towards the Gulf states. And sometimes the Gulf states actually act as a transit country out elsewhere. Now, the European Union has been unusually proactive and has passed and enacted legislation and policy preventing the importation of looted Syria material, full stop. And this is a very good thing for trying to control this illicit trade. In the United States, the legal situation is much more murky. The United States passed implementing legislation to the 1970 Convention in 1983, but it requires that the United States have a bilateral agreement with that country, and no such bilateral agreement exists with Syria. Now, in legal theory, Office of Foreign Asset Control sanctions against the Syrian regime through the Department of Treasury should be sufficient to stop the importation of illicit Syria material. But I'm not sure that's the case for antiquities, and I think that they're slipping through beyond that. And so really, to get on a firm legal framework here, there needs to be U.S. legislation.
Brian, if something were to show up at the University of Pennsylvania Museum, the Cultural Heritage Center, what is the policy? What's the protocol?
The University of Pennsylvania Museum will not acquire any material that does not have a provenance dating to 1970. It was the first museum in the modern era, followed by Harvard and the Smithsonian Institution, to take a very firm ethical stance that it would not acquire looted material. And it's something that the museum here is particularly proud of, and taking kind of a leadership role, even among international museums, in taking that position.
So if you come across looted material, then what do you do with it? Where does it go?
If we come across looted material, I mean, our obligation is to report it to authorities. And this is what we do.
Makes sense.
And, I mean, we're often called in to advise law enforcement, and we'll respond to law enforcement inquiries.
Not sure if we made this clear earlier in the program, but are there legitimate digs going on right now in Syria and Iraq? And if so, how do you distinguish what's coming out from those as to those compared to the relics which are illegitimate?
Well, obviously, there are no excavations going on in Syria at the moment because it's a war zone. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure. I doubt if there's anything happening in Iraq at the moment either, although I'm not sure up in Erbil in the Kurdish territories if anybody's still working there. I know they were working there until very recently. But even if there are excavations working, you know, archaeologists do not take material out and then go out and sell it. So, any material taken out from a legitimate archaeological excavation would never find its way to the markets. So it's not really an issue.
The International Council of Museums is urging museums and auction houses globally not to acquire or sell looted antiquities. But does the ICM request have any teeth to it?
It does not necessarily have a good deal of teeth to it. But I know that Sotheby's in particular, Christie's in particular, have been very, very sensitive to the issue of Syrian material. I'm not quite so sure that's true for other auction houses. And I think that there's a good deal of awareness among the international museum community that this is something that everyone has to be sensitive to. There was an event just on Monday at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, hosted by the director of the museum, Tom Campbell, in which Tom very forcefully reiterated the position that they are not acquiring any material from Syria and Iraq.
I'd like to get into a little bit more as we start to move toward the end of the show. Again, the danger of working on the border of Syria and trying to preserve these antiquities. You have sources, I understand, in Syria and Iraq. You say you cannot name them out of concern for their safety. So what is motivating them to talk to you?
I mean, I think that a lot of the motivation comes from kind of that moment about when I was talking about the family photos, that kind of like pithy little vignette of why, you know, people are motivated to save things in a crisis. And one of the things that struck me when Amr and I were in southern Turkey was how much you would hear from the individuals involved about how deeply they were committed to this work. Not in a sense of kind of a monetary personal gain, because they knew how badly their lives were at risk, but simply because they felt that they had an obligation, not necessarily even for their children, but their grandchildren, that they actually tried under these very dire circumstances to do something. Something for the future of the country.
I'd read of something called the Association for the Protection of Syrian Archaeology, which relies on an underground network of activists. Apparently, and Amr, tell me if this is correct to your understanding, Syrian authorities are suspicious if you take a picture, so informants will sometimes use tiny digital cameras inserted into pens to do what they need to do.
Yes, I mean, it's not just the Syrian authorities. I mean, obviously, it's locals, it's anybody who's engaged in looting, certainly
sure.
ISIS. I mean, all of these networks, I mean, including the group that you just mentioned, all these networks, small groups, gathering information and then trying to basically smuggle it out. It's very dangerous work, and therefore, we receive a lot of information, and for the most of it, we can't actually even sort of discuss it openly or show it or bring it out, because it endangers the individual who acquired this information. Using in some cases these hidden cameras, they'll walk into an excavation or they'll walk into an area where a particular deal is going on, and obviously, if that photo or image were to come out and become public knowledge, and the individuals who were concerned or involved in the activity would know that, well, only so and so and so and so were there, and therefore it must have been so and so by a process of elimination. So yes, it does happen, we all use these methods because it's highly dangerous.
Amr and Brian, in the remaining 30 seconds of the show, what are the experts you trained? What are they doing right now?
Right now, they are working to try and protect the mosaics of the Modern Museum, and they're working to photograph and do additional documentation, particularly around Aleppo and Idlib and the Dead Cities area.
Okay, and Amr?
In addition to that, gather information about how ISIS is basically arranging the buying, selling, transportation, and who's involved and where they're based.
Amr al-Azm, it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Amr al-Azm is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Middle Eastern History at Shawnee State University. And Brian Daniels, thank you so much for joining us. Brian Daniels, Director of Research and Programs at the University of Pennsylvania Museum's Cultural Heritage Center. He co-directs the Safeguarding the Heritage of Syria and Iraq project. By the way, don't forget to visit our Facebook page. And you can also find our podcasts by heading to our homepage, whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Thanks for joining us. Hour 2, coming up next.